This is a production of Cornell University.
Well, it's good to be at Cornell again. I think I've been to Cornell more times than I've been to Kansas State. And my daughter did her PhD here in systematics and ecology. So I've been here to see her and give talks and so on. I have to say, a fair number of the talks that I've given here have been met with a certain coolness and polite, but I didn't get invited to dinner. But there was one person here the whole time who has been kind to the Land Institute and its work. Dave Pimentel even came when he was invited to the first meeting among several scientists. The title of that was The Marriage of Ecology and Agriculture. And we had a little Rockefeller grant, and we came together, and we talked about this back in 1986. And so, my heart is warmed after talking to this group of graduate students today, and we'll see how this talk goes, because I'm going to talk about something that is in some respects more radical than perennial grains. The title I've given this for myself, mostly, is a question. Is what has been a series now becoming a succession? And let me back up. Alexander Pope, the poet, in his epistle to Burlington, has this line: "Let nature never be forgot. Consult the genius of the place in all." Wendell Berry, at the dedication of our greenhouse back in the mid-80s, gave a lecture on the history of the idea that nature had practical lessons for agriculture. And he began with Job, over 2,000 years before Jesus of Nazareth. And it's about where Job says, "Ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee, and the fowls of the air, and they shall tell thee, or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee." And then the next one Wendell mentioned was Virgil, the poet, in 36 to 29 BC. Virgil said this: "Before we plow an unfamiliar patch, it is well to be informed about the winds, about the variations in the sky, the native traits and habits of the place, what each locale permits, and what denies." And then Wendell jumped to the Romantic English poets, Edmund Spenser, in the late 1500s, talks about the equal mother of all creatures, who knittest each to each as brother unto brother. And then in Shakespeare, and this is because Marty Bender, who died just a few years ago, Marty Bender one day in class said, "What the hell did Shakespeare have to say about sustainability or whatever?" So Wendell went to work and there's a lot in Shakespeare about nature as the standard or measure. It's in As You Like It. He has the forest in the role of teacher and judge. And then Milton in the 1600s says about nature, "She, good cateress, means her provision only to the good that live according to her sober laws and holy dictate of spare temperance." Her provision only to the good that live according to her sober laws and holy dictate of spare temperance. And then Alexander Pope, in the late 1700s, just mentioned, "Let nature never be forgot, consult the genius of the place in all." Now, the next time this shows up is among the scientists. Wendell points out that after Pope, the idea of nature having practical value for agriculture or our lives generally departs from English poetry. And the romantic poets that follow look at nature only as a reservoir of symbols, nothing practical to be dealt with. So when it shows up again is with Liberty Hyde Bailey. In 1905, he had a book, 1915, and here is what Liberty Hyde Bailey probably wrote on these grounds. "If nature is the norm, then the necessity for correcting and amending abuses of civilization becomes boldly apparent by very contrast. And a good part of nature is to learn how to adapt one's work to nature." And another, "To live in right relation with his natural conditions is one of the first lessons that a wise farmer or any other wise man learns." Well, after Liberty Hyde Bailey, the next one that where it shows up is where Sir Albert Howard, who is a Brit and working in India. And here's what Howard said. This is in 1940. Now, remember, Bailey is 1905, 1915. "The main characteristic," this is Howard, "of nature's farming can therefore be summed up in a few words. Mother Earth never attempts to farm without livestock. She always raises mixed crops. Great pains are taken to preserve the soil and to prevent erosion. The mixed vegetable and animal wastes are converted into humus. There is no waste. The processes of growth and the processes of decay balance one another. Ample provision is made to maintain large reservoirs of fertility. The greatest care is taken to store the rainfall. Both plants and animals are left to protect themselves against disease." And then after Sir Albert Howard, J. Russell Smith, who wrote the book Tree Crops, says that we need to farm like the forest. Now here's something that Wendell said that I think is profound. He said a lot of things that are profound, but he pointed out that the idea of nature as a standard or measure having practical value comes only as a series in the formal culture. In other words, among poets and science in the formal culture. But he says it's a succession, in other words, continuity like a stream, in the common culture. Now, does anybody want clarification on that? All right, good. If you have a succession, it's not popping up like toast. You know, it's just coming right along, but that is has been the case in the common culture, according to Wendell. But only boom, 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 boom. Formal culture. job this time. All right, so come back to the title of my talk, which is the question, is what has been a series now become a succession? Are we now beginning to think more about that possibility? There was a time in which we had a good shot of it being in the common, in the formal culture with Hugh Hammond Bennett. 1935, it was, the Soil Conservation Service was organized, called the Soil Erosion Service, very quickly changed. And Hugh Hammond Bennett talked a lot about the four steps that the Soil Conservation Service employed. Now, let me give you a little background about Bennett. First of all, he had done a book, he was very smart, and he had high energy, and he put together an organization that Wellington Brink says, never in modern government had an organization been put together with more esprit de corps, people devoted to the common task of saving our soils. And at one time, I'm going to find this again. At one time, 1/7 of our total federal budget was devoted to soil and water conservation. Now, that's back during the CCC days, so there was a lot of make work projects around. But Bennett said, there are four steps. Number one, we set out to imitate nature. And we had farmer participation. Our men, he said, would walk over the fields with the farmers. And he said, I used publicity. I just let the news people go at it, the radio, the newspapers, the magazines. There were clippings that piled up. And then he also was very good at congressional relations. If he wanted an appropriation, now at the height of the Great Depression, he had it. For instance, there are two stories. I promise not to, feature digressions here because you can tell when a professor's getting old, the ratio of the anecdotal to the analytical gets distorted. senile rapture reigns. One time, Bennett was trying to get an appropriation, and there was a meeting. Of course, they didn't have air conditioning in those days in the Capitol, so they would have a little a table there, and they'd have a towel, and they'd have pitchers of water. And so Bennett went over and picked up a pitcher of water, apparently pushed the glasses aside, and just started pouring water on the towel. And poured half the water on the towel. And then he moved the towel to the side and poured the rest of the pitcher just on the flat table. And he said, I just stood there looking at the mess and said, gentlemen, they were all senators or congressmen were men those days. Gentlemen, here's what happens if you have cover. And here's what happens when you don't. Another time, the dust was blowing, and he got a telegram that there were some clouds coming in, some dust clouds, and he stalled the hearing until the dust came over Washington, pointed out the window, and got the appropriation. So this is the kind of person that, he had. Well, alongside the Soil Conservation Service, in 1940, an organization was put together in Columbus, Ohio, known as Friends of the Land. There were such people as Elder Leopold, Liberty Hyde Bailey contributed to the journal. We had E.B. White that contributed. Henry Wallace. All the great names of the time contributed to this journal called The Land Quarterly, and it said on the masthead, a society devoted to the conservation of soil, rain, and man. And it was in almost, well, lots of farmers' homes. Housewives may contribute their poetry. And it had another land section. But that whole organization was for the purpose of supporting the newly established Soil Conservation Service, because people knew then, remember, we're not using much fertilizer, we're not using pesticides, really, to speak of. And so they were worried, by the way, about the world population. You know, this is at a time, I mean, in my lifetime only, the world population has tripled. And since Kennedy, it's doubled. So even then, they were worried about it, and they were worried about it because we had not really brought the Haber-Bosch process to the farm in any big way at all. That's really not until about 1948. Backlog Spill says that without Haber-Bosch, for our nitrogen fertility, 40% of humanity wouldn't be here now. So, you know, these people were worried, and of course the breeding wasn't there to be able to respond to the fertilizers either. So what happened? Well, by the mid-50s, the magazine was waning, and it went out of business. And what happened? As the consequence of the fertilizer, the pesticides, the Green Revolution technologies, and so on, the emphasis that was given by the founding chief of the Soil Conservation Service went away. So here was the opportunity for the succession within the formal culture, and it just didn't last. All right, now, both the citizens' organization and the government failed, and we have to ask why. Well, I have three reasons, and I already alluded to this a bit. Number one, I think our nature. What I call the 3.45 billion year imperative. That is that all organisms, being carbon-based, we go after energy-rich carbon. I mean, that's what we do in the system. The ecosystems took care of it until the beginning of agriculture, when we essentially became the species out of context. And there was the beginning of getting at what I call the five pools of energy-rich carbon. First, the young pulverized coal of the soil. Of course, it was disruptive of the soil, too, with agriculture. The second pool, 5,000 years later, or 5,000 years ago, was the forest carbon that we used to smelt the ore for the Bronze and the Iron Age. And then 250 years ago, the third pool, coal, and then Drake's oil well, 1859, oil, and then right after that we start using natural gas for power. So here we have the five pools that we get after as a consequence of the 3.45 billion year imperative. In other words, we then, in the course of all of this, with the power of abstraction, design an economic system that's good at getting it. So, if you look at the curves, plot the curves, whether it's bacteria on a petri dish, or rabbits in Australia, or deer without predators, what we got is petri dish economics. So capitalism is nothing more than petri dish economics. And we worry a little bit whether we're being fair as we move to the edge of the Petri dish. So we got justice that's a part of it. But by and large, it's really nothing more than obeying the 3.45 billion year imperative. And look, even today, we're supposed to be solving all of our problems with growth. And so the big question becomes, you know, when you hit the edge of that dish, then what? Now you say, what's this have to do with perennial grain crops? I'll tell you in a moment. All right, so the first is our nature. In other words, the sources of our problem. The second is what I call the 10,000-year-old attitude problem. If we were to have this shut off, if you're to have an annual monoculture, you've got to destroy the natural ecosystem that's there. And so the idea that nature is to be subdued or ignored is as old as agriculture. And how, the bigger question is, how is it that we retain the idea of trying to follow nature given that our calories come from subduing nature? How is it that that is able to persist? Well, so that's one of the sources. And then a third source is the Enlightenment. You know, down around 1600, Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and the early stages of science, you know what they say? You break a problem down to the point where there's no ambiguity. And so what happens is a pecking order actually has developed within the disciplines. The least pecked over are the physicists dealing with things like atoms. The next least pecked over are molecular people. And then it just goes on up until the most pecked over are the ecologists. And that's a consequence of the history of science where you gain your power by being reductive. And so, I now want to tell a story. On May 10th, 10 miles northwest of the Kansas City Airport, we had a board of directors meeting and some friends of the land, people that had helped in our capital campaign. And we were having our drinks, our little things to nibble on, and witty conversation on a lawn. And the lawn was even with the second floor of the barn where we were going to have dinner. So that's a way of letting you know we were looking down on a field that was about 80 acres. And there was, to the right in that field, a slope, a fairly steep slope, with three terraces. So, a flat field, terraces, and then at the bottom of the field was a catchment pond, I would say a third as big as this room, third as the area of this room. The catchment pond was full of mud. The field was brown except for those green terraces. It had been burned down with an herbicide. And they were going to plant Roundup Ready soybeans or corn. The corn stalks were still there. So, all the system has to offer as its gold standard is two molecules. This is minimum gene, which is a molecule, and you've got a catchment pond loaded with mud, the corn stalks are still there. So what's going on? What do we have to offer? Well, what was at work there was, one, our nature. We want bushels per acre. So we're after, that's the 3.45 billion year imperative. We want that energy-rich carbon. We want the corn or the soybeans. The second thing that was there was the idea that nature's to be subdued or ignored. And the third thing at work was the reductive science moving downward in that hierarchy of structure. So, here's the revolution or conceptual change that I think is now possible. And that's to move up the hierarchy to the ecosystem level. And we can now begin to think seriously about that as we consider that essentially all of nature's ecosystems feature perennials in mixtures. Humans being forced to live with annuals in monocultures, I'm thinking primarily of the grains now, 70% of our calories, 70% of the acreage. So if we're to, if we are to be able to stop soil erosion and be able to take advantage of the efficiencies that are inherent within the natural integrities, we're going to need perennials in mixtures. And with species diversity, of course, we have chemical diversity, which means it takes a tremendous enzyme system on the part of an insect or a pathogen to give the epidemic. But what's been missing for 10,000 years in agriculture is what some in the computer industry would say, we had the wrong hardware. In other words, as long as you got that annual, you got a Sisyphus effort. You got to tear the ground up, or you got to poison it, you see. So we've been stuck, but now we have the potential for new hardware, and we can now begin to seriously think about an increase in perennializing the major crops. And I think you folks here ought to be quite proud of yourselves that right here on your campus you have people that are interested, more than merely interested, in making corn perennial, which is the killer of the continent. I think it's actually important that it be here at Cornell, given the history of corn research and the Nobel laureates associated with this place. But Ed Buckler, for instance, where are you, Ed? Yeah, there he is. There he is. He's just like one of us. Look at him. He doesn't look like a different species at all. He's even younger than some of us. So, I must say that this is beginning to get some traction. Now, what I'm arguing for is, though, that we've got to think about the ecosystem as a conceptual tool. It doesn't mean that we don't use molecules, but the molecular approach is subordinate to the what's required of us if we're to have an ecosystem like agriculture. That is a diversity of crop species. And here's why. Chris Field's paper in Science in 2002. Chris is at Stanford and Carnegie Institute of Washington. A survey of the ecosystems of the planet. Most natural ecosystems have greater net primary production than the human managed systems that follow. Greater NPP, that's one. system. Now, you may say, but agroecology is here. It's already happening. There is a movement. Well, yes. And now I'm going to, look, I'm not going to live long, so it doesn't bother me. Nobody's going to waste their time shooting me. So I'm going to irritate some of my friends working in agroecology there. Agroecology, as it stands, is the consequence of agronomic arrangements that agronomists have had, some of them going all the way back to the Romans. And in our time, we've had ecology, evolutionary biology in only, 70, 80, 100 years. So what we have found is some of those agronomic arrangements have to do with some ecological principles, and so we've slapped the label of ecology on some of those agronomic arrangements and call that agroecology. Now, also what's been happening in this broad field, this broad synthetic field of ecology, evolutionary biology, has been people at work to understand how these ecosystems work, and they're called ecologists and evolutionary biologists. And what they've done is put on the shelf
was ecology,
And they always thought, well, that plays around the edges instead of being regarded as a more comprehensive discipline that integrates biology with all the earth sciences. Ecology has that potential. The word environment, and by the way, that's a word that I would like to purge from the language, because it implies, by the way, my first book was Man and the Environment. Only two things wrong with that, Man and Environment. But the word environment implies that that there's an out there rather than acknowledging that we're enclosed within a miraculous skin, you know, within with other organisms. Look, the physical world gave rise to organisms. Organisms didn't give rise to it. But what we do is treat that physical world as nothing but, and then we play fast and loose with it. Witness the atmosphere and the climate change. That is non-biotic. So what I'm arguing for is, first of all, we acknowledge that the ecosphere is a supra, not super, supra-organism, which has embedded within it ecosystems, and then you can see for yourselves the other categories in the hierarchy. So I think we're going to find a new generation of students and scientists that are going to be paying attention to Bible's laws, 12 laws of integrative levels, and we're going to be paying attention to the writings of the likes of J. Stan Rowe, an ecologist that's now dead. He was at the University of Saskatchewan. He's got a book called Home Place. And we're going to be paying attention to some of the writings and thinking of Arnold Schultz, who is now retired from Berkeley. These are ecologists that have been looking up in the hierarchy of structure. And Stan Rowe is the one that, after Bibleman's paper on the laws of integrated levels, and there are these 12 laws, you know, Bibleman went from atoms to molecules to cells to tissues to organs to organisms, and then everybody was saying, well, what's next? This is 1951. What's next? And Stan Rowe said, well, what comes next? And what do they have in common? Some were saying species. Some were saying populations. Stan said, wait a minute. What do these others have in common? They have contiguous volume. Species don't have contiguous volume. Populations don't have contiguous volume. Ecosystems have contiguous volume. So what he gave us was the volumetric criterion for thinghood. And then following that paper came Arnold Schultz, who wrote, he was at Berkeley, the ecosystem as the conceptual tool for the management of our resources. He worked very hard to get that in Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and he mostly failed because the ecologists wanted to regard the ecosystem as a container rather than a slab of space-time that has properties of its own. So the world we're now living in, where the rainforest is helping regulate the hydrological cycle, where the vegetative structure is controlling the temperatures, and where what we do in Iowa creates dead zones. This will help us think ecospherically and start looking at those ecosystems not as mere containers where interesting things happen within, but having properties that are going to be necessary for the balancing of the ecosphere itself. Now, since humans are going to have to manage these landscapes for food and for fiber, we've got to be cognizant of the role of those landscapes in the larger ecospheric limits. So, so the idea of the necessity for the perennial, I think, represents some success. The idea is taking hold. And just give you some examples. And we may be seeing the beginning of a succession in the formal culture. Nick Jordan's paper in Science in 07. The Royal Society in 2009 with the paper Reaping the Benefits, Science and the Sustainable Intensification of Global Agriculture, where the perennial becomes mentioned again. Gottfey and others, Food Security, the Challenge of Feeding 9 Billion People in Science in 2010. The National Research Council of the National Academies Towards Sustainable Agricultural Systems. Jerry Glover and Reginold's Issues in Science and Technology. Glover's paper in Science that had 29 signatures of scientists from various places around the world, including this institution. And then Wendell Berry and I and Fred Kirschman took a 50-year farm bill to Washington. And we received from that office some language that Secretary Vilsack had sent to Obama, which would be part of the budget to go to Congress. And we had asked for USDA having 80 PhD geneticist plant breeder types working on perennial grain crops and 30 ecologist soil scientist types and a budget of $50 million a year. Well, we knew we weren't going to get that, but we put it out there, and there is now some language that has been presented to Obama, and we'll see whether Congress picks up on it. So the publications, a little bit of language out of the Secretary of Agriculture's office. So the summary question is the idea of nature as measure poised to become a succession in the formal culture. And we had two of our plant breeders just get back from Australia. Australia is working on perennial wheat. They've had some good luck. They've had some better luck than we had with the same germplasm that we sent them. The Canadians, University of Manitoba, a very vigorous program on the perennial wheat. University of Illinois, Lynn Wade, here at Cornell University, Ed Buckler. We're supporting the perennial rice program in China. That's for the upland rice, where they're planting on very steep slopes. And Stan Cox, our director of science research at the land, will be going to monitor that next month. Now, we have a motto at the Land Institute. Continuity is more important than ingenuity. And for this to be sustained, it's going to require, and especially during the coming bad times, as we come to the end of oil, natural gas, and so on, in order to keep that sustained, it's going to take a consecrated constituency. It's going to take people that will see to it that it continues. The Land Institute is set up just for that sort of continuity, but it's going to take more. I mean, we've got 600 acres, we got 31 people, we got native prairie, we got bison, we got the standards, and we got the breeders, and we've got a place to store our seeds that's tornado proof now, a building that's built to last a long time, but it's going to take this sustained effort. And if that can happen, then I think that what this will represent is the great moment for humanity where we turn the corner from agriculture being inherently a part of the extractive economy. Now, I'll tell you one other thing, and this is getting way out, according to some. We all know that growth is what's been destroyed. Economic growth has destroyed rainforests. Population growth. It's not been the greenhouse gas that's been destroyed. It's been the use of energy. We evolved within ecosystems. And we escaped. Is it possible that, let's say here is a natural ecosystem and its processes. And here is agriculture, out of phase. Is it possible that as we try to mimic the structure of the wild, in order to be granted the function, we can now have something of a isomorphic relationship? Now, the native prairie is a real economy. Nothing phony about it. Features material recycling, runs on contemporary sunlight. That's a real economy. So where do we find renewable economies? We find them in nature's ecosystems. So is it possible that where we slipped out 10,000 years ago, and as we struggle to come back and get in phase with our food producing system, we will be able to turn and find within this analogs, new metaphors for a way to live without petri dish economics informing our every action? I don't know. But it seems to me those are the questions that go beyond the available answers that have to be featured in this next round for the graduate students as well as their young professors of our time. I'll tell one last story. Jack Huell, Costa Rica, working in the tropical rainforest, and noting that all over the tropics, the slash and burn has accelerated and the length of time for rejuvenation had been shortened. Therefore, the nutrients in the ash were not supporting the yields that they had formerly. So he and his students took an area that had been cleared, and they had a few rules. They put back the vegetative structure of the surrounding wild ecosystem, and they substituted tree for tree, vine for vine, shrub for shrub. And one of the rules was that the plants that they brought in could not have got there on their own, but they were structural analogs of that wild surrounding. And Jack says, and he published this, of course, almost always, where we mimicked the structure, we were granted the function. Tight nutrient cycling, resistance to the insects, and so on. Now, Jack's idea did not come out of agroecology that was a derivative of agronomy that it had the label slapped on of ecology. It came from having reached over into that basket up on the shelf out of the broad discipline of ecology, evolutionary biology, pulling something out and dusting it off and applying. I'm arguing that this is what we need to do. We need to have the courage to have a lot of failures. And We need time for a lot of these failures to manifest themselves in the interest of getting at the various couplings that are going to be necessary to live with soil erosion, fossil fuel dependency, the introduction of chemicals our tissues have no evolutionary experience with, in other words, to live within our means, and always remembering that Chris Field's paper, those natural ecosystems have greater net primary production. And from the point of view of a breeder, that's what we look for, is the reallocation of some of that photosynthate to serve our purposes and us being willing to pay the bill for what's been taken away. So that's all I have to say. See these perennial roots.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.